hslva.org/homeschoolhelpers.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I thought it would be interesting for our Church and Culture listeners to listen to the first interview I did with Frank Buckley, who was on the inside of the Trump campaign as a speechwriter and advisor, to compare that interview with the one you've just heard after the election. So here from 6 months ago is Professor Frank Buckley of the Scalia School of Law talking about the issues leading up to the 2016 election. We talked about his last book, The Patriot King's American Friends, but he has a new book out, which is brand new, and it's very, very important, I believe. It's entitled The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America in an Age of Diminishing Expectations. This came out from Encounter, and it's available on Amazon. It has some excellent reviews already. Very well deserved, as I've been reading through it. And Frank, I think you've done a real service in focusing on this issue of income inequality. I mean, this is interesting because you are known as a conservative intellectual, someone who is more a man of the right than the left, but yet you pay attention to an issue which is normally one raised by the left and among those of the left. And you have a long argument about why we need to pay close attention to this issue, especially at this moment in time in American history. So tell us why income inequality is so important.
Well, I'll tell you why it should be important for conservatives. I mean, there are a lot of reasons, but I think the big one is if you don't take it seriously, essentially you've handed away the presidential elections for gosh knows how long to the Democrats, because they've made it their issue, and Republicans generally have not deigned to respond. It's as if they think, well, that's a Democratic issue. We're not going to go there, and you know, maybe it partakes of the sin of envy, which I don't think it does. And maybe it's a little bit about a white shoe party, the Republicans, that that's never felt entirely comfortable about the atavist, about the guy who's making it, the new man. I mean, that was, you know, when you think about that, you'll think of Reagan Democrats, but mostly that's been an issue historically for the Democratic Party, at least as far back as 1920.
Now, do you think you have become what you say here in the introduction, a traitor to your class?
I'd like to think so. I wish somebody pay me for it between us, but it's not like that. Well, it's a Franklin Roosevelt line. But do you remember Ronald Reagan's line about how he was a Democrat until the party left him? He didn't believe the party. There's a lot of conservatism, you know, that's taken as basically conservative, which is really old school liberal. And here I'm thinking of the honorable liberals of the 1950s, and they were strongly anti-communist.
Right.
And they were for civil rights, and they were for reducing the tax burden, and they were for welcoming people into American society. And those are all good things. And you know, that party died in the Democrats. It was replaced by you know, progressivism, but those themes reemerged weakly in the Republican Party. Now I think the Republicans should seize those themes and say, look, we're the party that can help people rise up.
So your point is that the kind of income inequality that we have in the United States has led to social immobility and the loss of opportunity, correct?
That's exactly right. And I look, you know, I'm a number cruncher. So what I did is I looked at the extent to which the earnings of sons track those of fathers. That's a measure of, that correlation is a measure of immobility. And when you look at it that way, you know, the country of opportunity, it's not America anymore, it's Denmark. I mean, the American dream was the dream that whoever you were, you could rise up. But, you know, George Carlin, the comedian, says it's called the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe in it. Well, there's an element of truth in that bitter jest. And so what we should be doing is looking at why other countries are beating us hands down on the issue.
And they're beating us also educationally.
Well, exactly. You know, we're, here's where they're beating us. They're beating us on education. They're beating us on immigration. They're beating us on rule of law. They're beating us on regulatory messes. In all of those ways, they are, in many respects, more entrepreneurial and more free than we are, and they are much more mobile. But I, here's, you know, the point I want to make is that this is not a small issue. This is how we think of ourselves as Americans. This is the American dream. I mean, it's at least as far as to Abraham Lincoln. And you know, if you ask someone to, you know, just talk about what's great about America, sooner or later they come to that. And for, you know, for people of a certain age, you know, who remember the 1950s as a time of, you know, wonderful mobility, it's a sad betrayal. You know,
certainly the world you and I were born into had this sense of the reality of this opportunity and mobility.
It was, we had a sense of it, and it was the reality of the time. You know, there's so many people who were the first people in their family to go to college during that period. You know, people who went to college by virtue of the GI Bill, for example. And everybody had a sense that things were going fabulously. You know, in some respects, we've made progress since then. I'm thinking of women and African Americans. But even women and African Americans back in the 50s had the sense that doors were being opened to them that had been always closed in the past. Now what we're hearing is the sound of doors shutting on us. We're hearing the sound of opportunities taken away. And I think that's particularly strong amongst, for example, the millennials. I mean, they're graduating with entirely worthless degrees, saddled with absurd amounts of debt, which many of them won't be able to ever pay off. And the job opportunities aren't there. So if they're going for Bernie Sanders, why should we be surprised?
No, my daughter is one of those, 27 years old, living in New York City, scrounging around for, you know, a good, substantial, satisfying job. I'm talking with Frank Buckley, who is foundation professor of at George Mason School of Law. And his book, which came out just a few days ago, and it's a wonderful book. It reads beautifully. I left a review on Amazon today. It's entitled The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America. And, again, perhaps the most startling and important thing about the book is here you have a prominent intellectual from the academy who's highly recognized and published, taking on an issue which really has belonged to the left, and that's income inequality. And you're making the point that this has created an immobility and a lack of opportunity which really guts the meaning of American exceptionalism.
Well, that's exactly right, and I blame... Well, two things, really. One is a new class of intellectuals, academics, lawyers, lobbyists, trust fund babies, media types who stand at the peak of American society. And they have arranged so that our policies are splendid if what you want is an aristocracy. So they're public enemy number one for me. But public enemy number two is a complacent Republican Party that has not been able to hear the voices of people who are upset at this. And worse still, I won't name names, people who scorn, you know, the middle class people as bigots, as drug takers and whatnot, but ignore how it is that people have fallen into despair by virtue of the lack of opportunity. You know, there's so many people. Well, here I will name a name. Mitt Romney came across as a guy who wanted to give you a pink slip, whereas Barack Obama, who created an economic mess, came across as a guy who had your back. Now, 2012 was the election. George Will said that if the Republicans don't win, they should get out of the business. And then they lost. And they lost because we had presented conservatism as a kind of political geometry formed from postulates and axioms from which you derive theorems. And it's bloodless, and it's not about people. What conservatism should be, however, is a movement that's connected to people. It should saddle up like William Cobbett and ride through the villages and see what people are thinking. Like Yeats's Seven Sages, it should walk the roads and mimic what they hear. Been itself captured by people of the new class and, you know, people who say, oh, it's just, you know, I've got this perfect 59-point plan, which nobody ever read, but they don't have a feeling for people. I am tired of people who are faithful to principles but lack compassion about people.
Yeah, there is a kind of compassion in your book, which you never talk about it much, but it's clear that you're writing this book because you're very worried about where America is going, whether opportunity can be restored, whether mobility can be restored. But when you write about the state of education and the difficulty of reforming education and the kind of incredible obstacles that are in place to educational reform, it made me wonder, how long will this take? Can it be done?
Well, it can be done. I tell a story in the book of someone who reacted with intense fury, anger about another aristocracy. Percy Shelley received news of the Peterloo Battle in 1819. That was where the yeoman cavalry attacked some Chartists in Manchester and killed some women and children. He received the news and he named names. He said, I saw murder on its way. He had a mask like Castlereagh or else. And then came fraud and he had on like Eldon and Ermine Down. But in the end, he said, you know, look, with all of these aristocrats arrayed against you, yet you have one thing going for you. Ye are many, they are few. And when I think of the unrest in the Republican Party, particularly Donald Trump, I'm reminded of that line, ye are many, they are few.
Do you think that the... I know you went to hear Donald Trump speak today in Washington, but I'm wondering if you would connect the thesis of your book with the very surprising support America is giving to Donald Trump.
Well, that would be a sign of arrogance on my part. I don't want to think that I'm leaving or responsible for any movement, but maybe I did try to capture the spirit of people who've simply had it. The book was sent to the publishers back in October, and I described how there were a group of insurgents at that point. Ben Carson was one of them. And that was entirely new in American politics. And since then, it's become stronger still, the sense of divide. And partly it's because of an incredibly arrogant class of conservative intellectuals who have nothing but contempt for Trump people and for, you know, ordinary working class Americans. I mean, you know, these are people who see themselves as an elite and really no different from the liberal elite in Washington. I'm here in Alexandria looking across the window at the Capitol, 5 miles away. These are people who kind of imagine, I think, to themselves that they speak with the accent of Katharine Hepburn in the Philadelphia story and live in some imaginary mid-Atlantic country south of Iceland and east of the New Yorker, a country nobody lives in. Whereas the country I live in is a country that's got monster truck rallies and hip-hop music, and it's got Johnny Cash, and it's got the Beach Boys, and it's got a spirit of getting ahead, and that's what I love about America.
Even though you're Canadian-born?
Well, you know, truthfully, there isn't much difference, if you want to know the truth. Although there is, and we were talking about education, and I think I'd mentioned to you before that I went to a public school in Western Canada, and all my teachers were nuns in their clerical garb. And it was a public school, and but then again, the town was 95% French-Canadian, so nobody much cared. One of my friends, an African-American judge, said, oh, didn't people get upset? And I mentioned, yeah, well, you know, it's true. There was a group that got upset, and their motto was one country, one language, one school system. That was a Ku Klux Klan. But, you know, one difference between the two countries is that there's a much stronger Catholic presence historically in Canada. And what that's meant is that the anti-Catholicism, so strong in the United States in the 19th century and lingering still among some people, it never really was much there. It was there, but these were people who always had to bite their tongue. So what you ended up with in Canada was separate school systems. You had Catholic systems, you had Protestant systems, public systems, parochial systems. And you know what that did is it gave you competition. And competition, I think, is a secret to why Canadian K-12 is so superior to the U.S. Somebody calculated, ran the numbers, and said that if miraculously our schools were raised to Canadian levels, it would have the effect of wiping out the national debt. It would have the effect of a $20,000 pay increase for every American. Okay, it's really that huge. If you're one of America's aristocrats, you don't want to change things, because if that's a ladder to the middle class, you don't want competition. You like things the way they are. So, you know my story about the opposition to vouchers and charter schools and particularly parochial school education. Well, there's some lingering anti-Catholicism there, but I think it's also a new class that just wants to preserve an aristocracy.
Well, you make the point that you make the point, Frank, that the solution is simple: school choice.
Absolutely. And you know what? Constitutionally, it's not a problem. Right? I mean, it's unless you're in the know, you wouldn't realize this. But the Supreme Court has blessed vouchers. What the Supreme Court has said is that wrong with a voucher system where you would pay full freight for a parochial education, provided that there is choice for public schools in the same area. Well, that's most of America. So where does the opposition come from? Well, it comes from, local cities, basically. It comes from, counties. It comes from cities. It's a grassroots opposition. It's a democratic opposition. It's led by the teachers' unions. But it's also well supported by this new class, which may be small in number, but which nevertheless dominates our policies and constrains what our options might be. So, these are the people who run the newspapers, who run the media, and these are the people who will tell you that giving people choice in education is just absolutely the worst thing. I mean, these are people who see the Spanish Inquisition behind every kind of any dog collar. I mean, this is just craziness. So I have contempt for the hypocrisy of people like that who'll send their kids to Tony private schools, which they can afford, but which would deny the opportunity for good schools for lower and middle class people. I mean, they wouldn't do it for themselves. I mean, even the vulture knows not to foul its own nest. But then, for the new class, it's not their own nest; it's the nest of the other.
I'm talking with Frank Buckley, who is Foundation Professor at George Mason School of Law, about his new book, The Way Back, about restoring America. And, Frank, I have a theory. I spent 15 years teaching philosophy in college and university. And prior to that, I spent a long time just getting 3 degrees. I think that parents, both in terms of their kids at public schools and their kids at colleges, simply cover their eyes when it comes to the issue of the quality of education their kids are getting. They don't want to believe it's as bad as it really is.
I think that's true. I think it's particularly true with higher ed. I mean, you know, so many of us, you ship your kids off to college, you drop them off, you shed a few tears, and that's it. And what happens afterwards? Why, there's a veil of ignorance. But what happens afterwards is these kids are not being educated. Let me put it this way. Suppose you wanted to design a purely aristocratic system of higher education. What you do is you'd have an extraordinary spread. Now, you'd have the best schools in the world. You'd have the Harvards and the MITs, and you'd have the worst. You'd have a big, big dispersion. Whereas in other countries, what you'd have is a smaller dispersion, tightly packed, with a higher mean than the United States, but lacking the right-hand tail of the best universities in the world, which is where the legacy kids go, right? So that, you know, that's what an aristocratic educational system would look like. So when people say, "Oh, we've got this great education system. Look at Harvard. Look at Yale." I look at it and I say, "Ah, yeah, aristocracy." Right. And what happens in most of the schools is just the craziness of the weirdest courses in the world. And you won't see that so much in Germany or France or England or Canada. It's there a little bit, but nothing like here.
Frank, you give the example of a 1912 eighth grade examination in Bullitt County, Kentucky. And this is just to get into the ninth grade. You have to be able to spell bequeath, monotony, rhinoceros, and synopsis. And in math, you have to find the amount of $50.30 for 30 years, 3 months, and 3 days at 8%. In geography, what waters would a ship pass through going from England through the Suez Canal to Manila? Civil government, to find 3 rights given Congress by the Constitution and 2 rights denied Congress. And in history, name the last battle of the Civil War, War of 1812, French and Indian War, and the commanders in each battle.
All of those.
That's a huge, huge, I should say, example of how we have lowered our standards in public education.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. You know?
Now, I'm sure you came across other ones.
The only one I got right was Jubilation 2.0.
You've tracked public education. I mean, I remember when I was teaching at Mercer University in Georgia. And I came across a curriculum for the general ed curriculum from Mercer back in the 1920s or 30s. And they were teaching natural law, metaphysics, Greek and Latin. I mean, it was a tough curriculum. And when I compared it with the general ed requirements that we were teaching by, it was, you know, pablum in comparison.
Yeah, and they take such pride, don't they, our teachers, in how they're instilling concerns for social justice amongst the students. It just makes you want to throw up. I mean, it's
when they can't write a coherent paragraph.
I know. You know,
or they can't give a coherent 10-minute talk on any subject.
It's like a Soviet department store, which was run for the convenience of the clerks. And not the shoppers, right? It's all about protecting the teachers and the heck with the students, which is, you know, inevitably the way government tends to work when there's no competition. And that's why opening it up would be so valuable. You know, one of the things I talk about in the book are one of my favorite directors is Leo McCarey.
Yeah, you talk about Going My Way.
Going My Way. And he was so funny. He was so witty. And he had such fun playing with Protestant ears about a Catholic education. The Catholic education, you know, it's taught by nuns, you know, with their coils. And it was just a regular American education, of course. That was the whole point. But there's one point in one of the movies, I guess, where, you know, the father, Bing Crosby, is in class and the kids are being put through their paces. And the nun says, now, Luther, tell Father McCall. And father says, Luther, how did he get in here? And, I don't know. Nobody
That's
knows.
That's great. And I can just see Bing Crosby crooning that.
Oh, man. They are amazingly funny movies.
Now, we got 2 minutes left in this segment. If we were to be able to simply wave our wand and create school choice for K through 12 all across the country, how long would it take for educational standards to be restored?
It would happen pretty darn fast. And you know what? And it wouldn't be noticed. The effect wouldn't be noticed. You know, it's not like there'd be something instantaneous. It rather would be, it would occur over years, 5 years perhaps. And at the end of that, nobody would know why it happened. Everybody would realize things are better, but nobody would realize why it happened. That's kind of how competition works. Things get better and you don't realize why.
And then you all of a sudden you look back and think, what were we thinking when we allowed education to be so soft, so undemanding, so fearful of memorization, so fearful of homework? Do I need to go on?
No.
I mean, we've made colleges and universities into 4 years of socials, parties, mating, simply sort of living on the parents' money and having a high old time.
Yep.
I mean, do you think is that too tough a critique?
Well, I thought just now you were describing my time at college. You know, that's what every kid wants. The difference was they didn't let us get away with it.
No, we didn't get away with it. Yeah, that's true. I would have loved it. I would have loved to have that kind of experience at the University of Texas between 1967 and 1971. But I remember when I received a C in physics, the only C I got in college, and I went to see the teacher, and he showed me that I had missed a B by 0.01%. And he would not budge.
Yeah.
I'm talking with Professor Frank Buckley from George Mason School of Law about his new book, The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America. And we'll be back right after this message.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Isaiah 50, verse 4 says, "The Lord has given me a well-trained tongue. Do you know how to watch your mouth?" Catholics have a tradition called charitable interpretation. That means that even when we feel like someone is being intentionally offensive, we should try to assume that maybe we're missing something, and instead of lashing out at them, give them the benefit of the doubt and ask them to explain themselves. The next time you feel like someone you love is doing something stupid or offensive or just plain old irritating, instead of snapping back, train your tongue to practice charitable interpretation and ask them this question. "Hey, when you said that, it kind of hurt. What did you really mean?" Then, listen to their explanation and work together to find ways to avoid misunderstandings in the future. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. The St. John of the Cross Fraternity Secular Order of Discalced Carmelites invites everyone to a free event Saturday, November 12th at Christ the King in Ann Arbor. After the 9 a.m. Mass, Christian Classics host Teresa Hofer will share, "Forever I Will Sing the Mercies of the Lord," St. Therese and the merciful love of the good God. For more information, call 734-578-2362. Swirl, smell, and sample delicious wines at the Cathedral of the Most Blessed Sacrament in Detroit, Saturday, November 12th. This Cathedral Cultural Series will feature a presentation from Mark Capitan, the artist who created the Cathedral's new St. Anne sculpture. Reserve your place today by calling 313-237-5782. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077.
I'm back with Professor Frank Buckley of the George Mason School of Law. We're talking about his very important book, in my opinion, The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America, published a few days ago by Encounter. Beautiful book, by the way. Great cover, great binding, nice paper, very easy to read. Frank, where does the immigration issue fit in this narrative of a America that has become immobile, socially immobile, because of the income disparity between the top and the bottom?
Well, I think it's absolutely huge. What we are doing is importing immobility. And so one way of looking at this is compare how immigrants fare as against natives, how the children of immigrants do against natives of their generation. And what you find is that the immigrants underperform relative to Americans, and the effect lasts through to the second and third generation. So we are actually importing immobility. Why are we doing it? Well, you know, one reason is politics. We're importing Democratic voters. We're also, in a class sense, we're importing maids and gardeners for the new class and excluding the talented people who would compete with them. Now, the contrast in my mind always is with Canada, since I'm a dual. Let me tell you firstly what Canada does with illegals. It deports them. I mean, you get a chance at a refugee hearing, and if you flunk that, you're on a plane. As for regular legal immigrants, which is even a greater problem than illegals, America has very strong family preferences, which means basically, you know, which decidedly gives an advantage to people from Mexico and Central America. But it's a question of are we bringing in your mother, your father, your child, your uncle, whatever. Whereas family preferences are really fairly weak in Canada, and a country one-tenth the size of the U.S. actually imports in absolute numbers more economic migrants in the U.S., but 160,000 a year in Canada versus 140,000 a year in the U.S. These are the guys who are likely to create jobs. And when they do it in Canada as well, what they do is they have these shifting criteria. So what they're saying is, you know, we really need engineers in Alberta, right? So if you're an engineer and you're willing to go to Alberta, and you pass everything else, you're in. We do absolutely nothing like that. And as for family preferences, you know, back in the 19th century when you left the old country, it was the long goodbye. Well, see, now you've got cheap airfare and you've got Skype and you've got, cheap mobile phones, and it's not the long goodbye. I mean, you can go back to the old country twice a year and not worry about it too much. That is to say, the moral case for family preferences is extremely weak. The case for preferring Americans at a time of high unemployment is very strong. And I am so dismayed at the open borders crowd of people who are basically saying, well, we don't care about Americans. I find that contemptible. Words fail me. I cannot begin to understand people so lacking in a sense of patriotism that they would not prefer Americans to people trying to come from outside.
How do you explain that sort of not natural, but odd preference?
Because people in the class I'm describing are so far removed from ordinary Americans, they will just never rub up against them, right? I mean, your entire life, from your private school to your Tony University to your professional career, you are surrounded by people exactly like you, and you have nothing to do with the guys who listen to, you know, country and western. You know the old joke, I like both kinds.
The NASCAR crowd, so to speak.
The NASCAR crowd, yeah. I mean, and people are like Johnny Cash, man. I mean, these are people I like, essentially. But mostly, the crowd I'm describing just couldn't care less. I mean, they'll live lives as isolated from ordinary Americans as if they were living in Switzerland. So, of course, they don't prefer the Americans to the Swiss. I mean, that's just not their experience. And moreover, I think there's a certain contempt that they feel for ordinary Americans. And that's partly Donald Trump as well, right? I mean, Trump is a basic American type. He's kind of Chuck Schumer. He's Sam Slick, the clockmaker. He's a fast-talking Yankee traitor. He is a person who, like Johnny Cash or Muhammad Ali, could never be anything other than an American. And that is, in part, I think, why our elites hate him, because they look at him and they see someone who is a member of their country, and it is the rage of Caliban looking at its image in the mirror. They don't like to be reminded that they're American. They would like to think of themselves as sort of European.
You talk in your book about... You talk about the character Ragged Dick from a novel by Horatio Alger. Is there some connection between Donald Trump and that character?
Well, let's see now. Horatio Alger's Ragged Dick, a much despised children's novel, but a funny one notwithstanding, traditional American virtues of pluck and industriousness and getting ahead spirit. He starts with absolutely nothing, and at the end of the book you can see he's starting to work his way up. Trump had a head start.
Oh, yeah.
Let's be candid.
Yeah. Do you think that he will address the immobility issue?
I think he will. I mean, he's not focused on it clearly yet, but he's on the right side of it with respect to immigration. He's on the right side of it with respect to a foreign policy. He gave a speech today, which is an American first foreign policy.
This was in Washington at the Mayflower Hotel, right?
Yeah. The internationalist crowd talks about responsibility to protect, RTP. And so you send Americans to fight in foreign lands to protect foreign countries. Well, when it comes to it, we haven't protected our own. We've let them die in Benghazi. And we've lied when asked to explain how that happened. So I think an American first foreign policy would be one which would be protective of American interests. Trump hasn't spoken about education. He has spoken, he's given some hints about campaign finance. And he's not a friend of the donor class. I mean, he's self-financed, but he's not raising money from the donor class. Meanwhile, the donor class in question is decidedly anti-Trump.
Oh, yeah.
They can spend unlimited monies through super PACs.
Right.
This is blessed by the Supreme Court. Gosh knows what will happen at the Supreme Court now. Everything's up in the air. But our system of campaign finance deserves a close look. We have, the greatest system of patronage and influence across the city I'm looking at right now of any country, of any time in world history. And in part, that has to do with the lobbyists of K Street, the associations of My Alexandria, the Beltway Bandits, down the river in Crystal City. That's unmatched in other countries, and free spending ways with respect to campaign finance may have a lot to do with it. It's a complicated issue because strict campaign laws can also produce more corruption than they cure when they're administered by the lowest learners of the world. So it's a tough issue, but to the extent that he's looked at that, it seems to me he's taking the problem of crony capitalism very seriously. And this is really what I'm describing. I mean, see, I've nothing against the basketball players, the New York Yankees guys, the Silicon Valley gazillionaires, the guys who are the 0.1%. But but what I'm talking about is the the lawyers, the academics, and I'm one of them, comfortably ensconced, the people who don't take risks, and these are our aristocrats. And, there's something very contemptible about us, I have to say, because when you compare us, the aristocrats of today, with the people who were aristocratic 500 years ago, back then, they had a sense that they had to serve their country, that they had privileges, but they were going to get their heads knocked around a little bit in battle as a consequence. And even 50 years ago, Yale served the same role as Cambridge in England in sending people to the CIA, for God, for country, and for Yale. I wonder if anybody ever says that at Yale right now. I'm sure they're quite embarrassed about all of that. So we don't have our new class like the aristocrats of 500 years ago. We don't have our battle scars and our medals, but we have our blogs and we have our CDs, and it's a sad trade.
The fact that one of the Koch brothers would come out and even entertain supporting Hillary Clinton is a very good example of what you were talking about with the donor class. I mean, how is that? How can you even explain that?
I see that as poker. I see that as Charles Koch saying, "Well, show me what you've got, Donald Trump. Show me what you believe in." That's fair game. If it's a game of bluff, essentially. What he's saying is, "Look, I don't know who I'm going to support. I don't know if I'm going to support anyone. I don't know if I'm going to support Hillary, but let's see what you've got." That's fine. But as for the Never Trump crowd that says it might vote for Hillary Clinton, for them I have nothing but contempt. I'm a Pascalian, so Pascal said, to the free thinker, you have to choose. And Sartre said something very much like that. You have to be engagé. You have to make a choice. The free thinker says, I don't have to choose. I don't have to choose to believe.
Frank, another really...
Yes, you do. You've already made your choice.
Another really important part of your book is your chapter on criminalizing entrepreneurship. Could you tell our listeners what you're getting at in that chapter?
Well, as it was meant to be, criminal law was based on intentional wrongdoing. And that was really a gift of the canonists, of people like Abélard, right? I mean, up to that point, if a tree fell on somebody, it didn't matter if there was no intention to harm you, you're guilty. And Abélard said, no, God considers the intention behind the act. So after that point, we didn't have crimes unless there was an intention to do wrong. Why is that important? Well, there's this thing called the conscience. So if you are doing wrong, you'll know it. But starting about 100 years back, we gave up on the intentional element in wrongdoing. We passed laws that said you could be guilty of a crime even if you didn't intend to do wrong. So you could do wrong and not have your conscience twigged, right? So you wouldn't.
What was the sort of signal event of that change?
Well, it was a move towards a regulatory state. I mean, it stemmed from people like Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. And Woodrow Wilson. It was what was called public welfare crimes. And the idea is that public welfare is so important that individual liberty is to be trumped by it. So we may send people to jail who don't have a guilty mind because it's important to protect the public welfare. But, you know, so there's that. And then the other thing is we have a literally numberless number of federal criminal crimes. So, you know, you can commit three felonies a day and not know about it. There's so many rules out there. And because there's no requirement of a bad mind, your conscience won't be twigged. So you go around breaking the law. You don't have a clue what you're doing. I mean, there are all these, you know, people going to jail for things like using the wrong wrapping paper for sending packages somewhere. And meanwhile, you've got, you know, across the river, and you've got an EPA, for example, staffed by many thousands of people who would die to put you in jail. Right? I mean, in part, it's a function of the fact that we're wealthy and we can afford this nonsense. I mean, I suspect that in Albania, they've got an EPA, but if you phone somebody up and you say, look, I've got a problem with wetlands, there are only three people in the office, and one of them's using an old Remington typewriter. But, you know, here you've got 100 lawyers just waiting to put you in jail. So you've got that, and then you see it turned around against enemies of the state. I mean, we've got a populist society and one that likes taking people down. And criminal charges filed against people like Martha Stewart, for example, it can't be understood except in the sense that we love to tear people down. And then again, we also have the possibility of politicized crimes, right? So in a highly corrupt and politicized society like, say, Russia, You remember what Lavrentiy Beria said. He said, show me the man and I'll show you the crime. Well, you know, it's so easy to break the law, it's pretty easy to find a politician who's broken the law. And we're not quite there yet. We're not Russia, but then again, we're sure as heck not New Zealand either.
I've sat on the corporate board of a publicly traded company and sat on the audit committee for nearly 20 years. And I know exactly what you're talking about. This company went through some very hard times with the SEC over regulations which were, you know, comparable to the Talmud.
Yeah.
And is that what you're talking about when you're criminalizing entrepreneurship?
That's what I'm talking about. But also I'm talking about a criminal justice system, which is the shame of the country. It's so easy to be charged a federal crime. Your chances of emerging innocent are less than 1%. They're about half of 1%. Because 97% of people charged will plead guilty, in other words. And of the remaining 4% of them, more than three quarters will be found guilty.
Well, the federal government has an unlimited resource of money and lawyers.
Yeah, and for that one half of 1%, these are people who had just had their three previous years of their life taken away fighting the vast number of lawyers and bureaucracy of the Justice Department. All the rules of civil procedure are geared towards putting you in jail. And for prosecutors who misbehave, who hide the evidence, there are no sanctions, right?
Well, it's like there's no accountability at the IRS.
That's right. Yeah, and what one saw in the IRS is basically found as well in the Department of Justice. So it's an incredible system of abuse.
And you think that makes people gun shy when it comes to building businesses?
Yeah, but for America's aristocrats, no problemo, because they're surrounded themselves with batteries of lawyers, so they can work it out. And moreover, they have all the influence in the world. They're part of the class that runs the country. They're not going to worry about it. The guy who's going to worry about it is the new man. It'll just wander around starting a new business. I mean, Martha Stewart, for example, did something absolutely foolish. She talked to the FBI without speaking to her lawyer first. That was it. She lied to the FBI about something which, had she told the truth, it wouldn't have been a crime.
Right.
All right. So But that was enough.
Isn't your point also made when looking at the Hillary Clinton email issue? I mean, she's got so much pull inside the Obama Justice Department. I'm very doubtful. I'd be willing to bet she's never charged with a crime.
Well, I think you're probably right. I mean, the president's already signaled that she shouldn't be charged with a crime.
How appropriate was that, by the way?
Oh, completely inappropriate. But you know, like I keep saying, we're not Russia, but then again, we're not New Zealand. What people are saying is, well, let me ask you this. People are saying, oh, it'll come to a head when the FBI recommends a prosecution and justice decides it's not worth doing, and the head of the FBI, Comey, resigns. Right? I've heard so many people tell me that's what's going to happen. And my response is, so he resigns. Right? We're at the point in America where that won't be a problem. Right? We're at the point in America where these sorts of things happen and nobody pays attention. I could mention a number of examples involving inspectors general who were shamed by the Democrats for whistleblowing, for finding a problem. And the very idea of an inspector general is you're supposed to do that. Russell George was the IG for the IRS, and he was the reason why Lois Lerner confessed about the Tea Party scandal. And afterwards, Russell George, it was suggested, had committed a crime. By, members of the House Judiciary Committee suggested that Russell George had behaved improperly. Gerald Walton, who was an inspector general elsewhere, I've forgotten, was fired for incompetence by Obama after he revealed that a friend of Obama had expropriated embezzled $800,000. Neil Barofsky, the inspector general of the TARP monies, could tell a similar story. So we have all kinds of stories about these sorts of things happening, and we're past the point where anybody cares.
Why is that? Why do we not care?
Well, it's a gradual sort of rot. It's what happens when the line between politics and justice is erased. What the rule of law, the sense of justice requires, is that it's applied without partisanship, without regard to politics. But that doesn't describe America anymore. You know, it's funny. I was at the Trump speech. And I ran into a friend of mine, Bob Costa, at the Post, and he introduced me to one of his colleagues, Bob Woodward, and I was so impressed. I mean, I've watched All the President's Men recently, and I'm reading the book, and this guy is an American hero.
He's not pushed around by the Obama administration at all.
Yeah. But how many Bob Woodwards are there? I mean, instead, what you have, pick up something like the Washington Post, and there are some reporters left, like Costa, but mostly there are cretins who write stories about people they hate.
Right. It's entirely become politicized and partisanized.
Yeah.
There's no news reporting anymore.
Yeah, so this, you know, when you're down that route, you're down in the direction of South America,
right? or Russia.
Now, you should never bet against the home team, and you should never make predictions about the future, and you should remember that whenever you think it can't get any worse, it doesn't. So I don't get pessimistic, but I have fun fighting battles.
We have a minute left, and I want to say that your book is very positive and hopeful. It offers concrete recommendations for restoring the promise of America, which is your subtitle. The main title is The Way Back, published by Encounter. Wonderful book. I've reviewed it myself on Amazon, and I plan on writing a review for the website, The Christian Review. Frank Buckley, thank you very much for coming once again on Church and Culture.
Neil, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And to all who are listening, please join me again on this day at this time.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
Have you ever heard Al Cresta's dramatic story of redemption and conversion? Hi, I'm Peggy Stanton. Join me on Power from the Pews when I interview Al during our Ave Maria Radio Mediterranean pilgrimage through Greece and Turkey and learn the personal history of a remarkable man. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Jeremiah wrote these words to the Jewish people who had been forced into exile. They were no longer in their own country, no longer in the Promised Land. We too may feel like those exiles, like strangers in a strange land. So what advice did Jeremiah offer? It was simple. Plant gardens, build houses, get married, and have kids. In other words, thrive. He also told them to pray for the country in which they lived, for its welfare would be their own. When we feel like exiles, we should do the same. Thrive by living in joy, pray for the welfare of our country, and trust in God's plan for our future and hope. To learn more about biblical advice for our daily lives, visit the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan on Facebook or cbsmich.org.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, the Byzantine season of preparation for the coming of our Lord is beginning. It is called the Philip's Fast. Perhaps now, more than ever, this preparation period needs to be taken very seriously.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
The gospel today is about the key virtue of humility. We're allowed to see humility in action. Will people consider you a humble person? I hope so. I really hope so. It's a key virtue. Listen to what Jesus said to his apostles. Who among you would say to your servant who just come in from ploughing or tending the sheep in the field, come here, sit down, and take your place at table? Wouldn't he rather say to him, prepare something for me to eat, put on your apron and wait on me while I'm eating and drinking, then you can eat when I'm finished? Is he grateful to that servant because he did what was commanded? So it should be with you. When you've done all that you've been commanded, say, we are unprofitable servants. We've just done what we were obliged to do. Now, not many people outside Christian society talk about humility. The world around us promotes pushing oneself forward and boasting. Lots of Christian people talk about humility, but humility in action, which is what Jesus wants, means living it out, getting on with our responsibilities in life without glamour, without limelight, day in and day out. It may not be a very showy virtue, but it does form our character and shape our souls. The Lord has placed each of us in circumstances that will prepare us for heaven, so trust Him in this and get on with it.